The Book Nook on WYSO is made possible by 5 local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Midpoint Library System, Clark County Public Library, and the Dayton Metro Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today Teresa Kaminsky. Hello, Teresa.
Hi, Vic. Thank you for having me.
Teresa, you have a new book out. It's called Angels of the Underground, The American Women Who Resisted the Japanese in the Philippines in World War II. And looking at your bibliography, I see that this is an area and a region and a time of great interest to you. Tell us about your earlier work and what led you to write this one.
Sure. It's true. I kind of refer to this book as the third installment in my Philippines trilogy. It didn't really start off that way. I only expected to write one book on the topic, and I'd started off back in 1999 with Prisoners in Paradise, where I was looking at the experiences of American women in the Pacific Theater. Most of them were actually interned by the Japanese for the duration of the war, and I was just really fascinated by this notion of civilian captivity and the fact that these were women who had to go through this ordeal, and many of them women with children along with them.
And that was the first book?
And that was the first book. And I did have a couple of chapters in that book where I talked about some women who managed to evade internment by creating false identities. And so the women who I talk about in Angels of the Underground had made shorter appearances in that first book. Mm. And I always kind of referred to that as the real exciting section of that first book, because these were women who were out and doing what they could to interfere with the Japanese occupation. And after a few years, it became apparent that they deserved a book of their own.
And these four women are very different. Let's talk about each one of them.
Sure.
And how they ended up where they were, because you really go into some depth as far as just how they ended up in the Philippines, because it really wasn't that easy for a couple of them, was it?
Right. Considering the distance from the United States, just in terms of geography, and also it was a really big cultural change, at least for 3 out of 4 of these women. One, Yai Panlilio, actually had a Filipino mother, and she was really interested in getting to the Philippines as quickly as she could when she was a teenager, and she always considered that to be home. She always talked about having 2 countries, both the United States and the Philippines. But the other 3 women, Caucasian, but just always with a kind of a streak of adventure. And I think in the early 20th century, you had to be a little bit adventuresome to pack up and move that far away from home.
And Yai was a journalist in the Philippines and eventually became a guerrilla.
Right. And her story is kind of maybe the least of the 4 women in terms of material throughout the story, because she's kind of an outlier because she was with a guerrilla band. We see her story kind of moving in and out of these other 3 women. She was basically on the run for most of the duration of the occupation, because the Japanese were pretty relentless in hunting down all of the guerrillas, and it made for an extremely difficult life for her, and she suffered a lot in terms of physical problems, and I suspect, too, emotional issues as well.
And then we have Gladys. Is it Savary?
I think just Savary, okay. But I'm not sure. I know she was married to a Frenchman, and she, from a fairly young age, she liked to travel. She had been out to Asia once before her marriage. She then ended up in Europe as a representative for a company that made Mahjong games, which were quite a fad in the United States in the 1920s. And she ended up kind of stuck in Europe when the company went out of business. And she decided to go to Paris and study French. And somebody introduced her to André. And they got married. And André was an engineer, about as interested in travel as Gladys was, and they eventually settled in the Philippines in Manila and decided to open up a French restaurant.
And as the war was occurring and the Japanese occupation took place, as an American, she probably would have been interned, but the Japanese considered her to be French, even though they didn't realize she was actually divorced.
Right, and that's I think that that's a secret that Gladys tried to keep for most of that time, and it may have had to do with a lot of different things, but certainly during the occupation, it was to her best interest that everybody simply referred to her as Mrs. Savary or Madame Savary, and she always referred to her husband, although I do have what I think is fairly strong corroboration that she and André had actually gotten divorced in the late 1930s. And the Philippines, being a very Catholic country, that would have been very unusual.
Mm. Teresa Kaminsky joins us. Her book is Angels of the Underground, The American Women Who Resisted the Japanese in the Philippines in World War II. These last two women really get, I think, a large percentage of the book to themselves. These last two are, I think, of the four, are the most fascinating. I don't know if you would agree with that, but they have, wow, interesting lives, and they went through a lot. We have Claire Phillips and Peggy Utinsky.
Right, and Claire had gone to Manila because she, all her life, she wanted to be famous. She was a singer, and I guess she was a pretty good one. And she just, in the United States, had a hard time getting a foot in the door anywhere. And she decided to try her luck elsewhere. And she and a friend first went to Hawaii. And when that didn't really pan out, they just headed on to the Philippines. And she did pretty well there in terms of being able to land some jobs, and especially by 1941, when there were fewer American women left in the Philippine Islands, many of them had packed up and returned stateside. By then, she was a pretty rare commodity, and she could sing and pretty much do whatever she wanted at different nightclubs in the city. And then, of course, that's what she parlayed into a kind of a spy ring during the war.
And she kept trying to prove that she wasn't an American. This was a big problem.
Right, and this was more of a problem for her, although along the same lines as Gladys Savary, Claire Phillips was married to a Filipino, and she didn't like to talk about that very much after the war, I think, because it didn't fit too well with her persona that she was creating. But she was married to a Filipino, and just by using his last name, that would have afforded her some protection from internment. But she also just concocted this very elaborate nationality, also claiming that she had been born in the islands and her parents were Italian. And so for all of those reasons, she didn't deserve to be interned.
And then the final woman in this group who, I don't know, if I had to pick one of the four that I think was the most heroic, it would be her.
Yeah, Peggy Utinsky, she's actually the reason why I came back to write this book, because I think you're right. Out of the four of them, she's the one that I just couldn't stop thinking about and really wondered about all of her experiences and how she managed to accomplish what she did. She had gone to the Philippines intending it to be just a vacation, probably sometime in the late 1920s, and she had been working as a nurse in the United States, and she thought it would be a nice vacation, but she fell in love with the islands, and she also met an American over there, and they fell in love and got married, and she considered the Philippines her home. And when the war started, her husband, Jack, who was a veteran of the First World War, her husband joined up with the U.S. military there and went off to fight. And so Peggy decided she would do whatever she could in Manila to help the war effort. And that ended up being a pretty dangerous scheme to try and smuggle supplies into the military prisoners after the Philippines fell to the Japanese.
I think for any listener that is interested in the history of this region during this period, that you have it all right here. Let's share some of the history, because a lot of people probably aren't familiar with what was happening in the Philippines and how shortly after the attack on Pearl Harbor, the Japanese invaded, and we were woefully unprepared for that, weren't we?
Very much so. And I always consider myself just really dabbling in military history. There are some really good works of military history about the Pacific Theater, and I did rely very heavily on them to set up my chronology for the background of all of this. But it did always strike me that, especially considering the geographical distance between the Philippines and Japan, that something just went wrong in terms of preparation. But I think a lot of the military higher-ups in the United States really knew from the very beginning that the Philippines could not, in fact, be defended against the Japanese. And the Americans and the Filipinos would just have to do the best they could in any given circumstance, and then just wait to see how it all played out. And of course, things got really, really bad before they got better out there.
Well, Manila, they just basically abandoned Manila,
Right. And that was really a strategic move, I think, and probably one of the best things that could have happened, because when General MacArthur declared Manila an open city, he made sure that all of the military and or all of the American and Filipino military personnel had been removed from the city, so that the Japanese knew it was not being defended, and that really saved the physical environs of the city and all of the civilian population in it. So that just meant at the beginning of January of 1942, the Japanese could just walk in and occupy the city without any further death and destruction.
Even though it should be noted that despite the fact it was declared an open city, the Japanese did start bombing it.
Right, and the bombing had actually been going on since, being on the other side of the international dateline, that was on December 8th, so really hours after Pearl Harbor, areas in the Philippines were already being bombed by the Japanese, and that continued throughout the month of December, and the Japanese then began making landings on the island of Luzon and were headed for Manila. They figured once they got Manila, they would be able to force the capitulation of the entire island. But the Americans and the Filipinos just moved their military forces into the Bataan Peninsula and expected to hold out there until American reinforcements could arrive. But of course, after Pearl Harbor, there really weren't reinforcements to arrive to help.
And they were also dug in at Corregidor and had these gun emplacements that were set in one direction because they were expecting to be attacked by sea. But since the Pacific Fleet had been really knocked out at Pearl Harbor, these gun emplacements were virtually worthless because the Japanese were coming from the other way.
Right. Once the Japanese secured the surrender, especially of the Bataan Peninsula, it only took about another month for them to just, from using their positions on the peninsula to fire onto Corregidor, and the constant bombardment there must have just been excruciating. And then finally, that small island, which everybody had nicknamed the Rock, just couldn't withstand that anymore. So there was then the follow-up surrender at Corregidor. So by the spring of 1942, that occupation had been secured, and the Japanese took thousands of American Filipino prisoners and put them into POW camps, which were really very poorly supplied.
Teresa Kaminsky joins us. Her book is Angels of the Underground, The American Women Who Resisted the Japanese in the Philippines in World War II. Yes, the Americans surrendered at Corregidor. And to the Japanese, this made them unworthy of respect.
Right. And we had already seen that the month before with the surrender at Bataan, which resulted in the death march. The Japanese had been unprepared for that many prisoners. They either assumed that in the battle they would kill all of the American and Filipino soldiers, or that the soldiers who remained would be so humiliated that they would, I assume, commit suicide. So the Japanese just weren't ready for that large amount of prisoners. And the first camp that they were sent to, Camp O'Donnell, just was barely ready to house prisoners. And the Japanese didn't have transportation in place. They just were unprepared. And that meant then that even more prisoners died. And it really was a very horrific experience for those men.
This is a work of nonfiction, yet much of it reads like an espionage novel. You have all this intrigue. You have assumed identities, people hiding out in buildings trying not to be detected, people smuggling documents and food and weaponry and all this going on. And I had to wonder as I was reading it, since so much of this was clandestine and cloak and dagger, how did you figure out what was actually going on and what these women were up to? How did you find records of it?
Yeah, and that's been a real challenge. The four women in the book did each write a memoir, and I mean, we all know about memoirs. They are very selective reminiscences of certain times in your life. And it is, each memoir really does position one of these women as a hero in her own life story. And so it is hard to kind of find corroborating evidence. A really, really close reading of Claire Phillips's book and Peggy Utinsky's does show that their stories do pretty well match up. Peggy created an underground network that Claire Phillips eventually became part of, so there was that corroboration. I also did find the, this was very generously shared with me, the diary of an American Army officer who was one of the guerrillas in the hills, and he actually wrote in his diary about meeting Peggy Utinsky, and this was in the latter stage of the war, and she had gone to the hills to escape the Japanese, and so he wrote about her and what she had told him and what she did in the hills with his guerrilla band. So finding those bits of evidence did take a lot of time, and there were also some references to these women in documents from the National Archives, which has collected papers of the American POWs in the Philippines. So a lot of scattered references that all had to be brought together and some sense made out of all of them.
Was that John Boone who wrote about her?
Actually, Boone did not write very much about Peggy and Claire, although he was one of the guerrillas that had these two women in common. I was actually thinking about Lloyd's journal.
Okay.
He turns up at the very end of the book, but John Boone was the other American guerrilla. He first made contact with Claire Phillips fairly early on when she was hiding out in Bataan. And he didn't leave much of a written record, but some of his papers are in the MacArthur Library in Virginia. So there are some references, some post-war testimony and letters from him as well.
That is so eerie when she finds these three American soldiers hiding, and she gets them to come out by speaking English.
Right. She, Claire, taking a real big gamble that there were no Japanese around. And at that point, she was just so anxious to find the man she referred to as her husband, another American soldier, John Phillips. And she was hoping to find him again. And so she was willing to take the risk. She knew that there were three American soldiers who had gotten separated from their units, and she was trying to find them, and she knew that they were still kind of hiding, and so the only way she could draw them out was to speak English, and luckily it worked out for her, and she met up with the three men, and then over the next weeks and months kept in contact with Boone, who was anxious to form his own guerrilla band and keep the resistance going from the hills.
Claire and Peggy did have that in common. They were both highly motivated to try to find that these men were still alive, that they were in love with, or that they were ostensibly married to.
Right. And Peggy then, she wanted to find her husband after the surrenders, and she ended up signing on to work with the newly organized Philippine Red Cross. And she was part of a medical team that was given permission by the Japanese early in the occupation to go into the Bataan Peninsula as long as they would only help Filipino civilians. They were not to talk to any American prisoners they ran across. They weren't supposed to acknowledge them, but of course that's what Peggy was doing, and she was able to do this because she had false identity papers that showed her as a citizen of Lithuania, which the Japanese were willing to chalk up into the Axis category, and so she managed to evade internment, and she went to the Bataan Peninsula, and she did quite a bit of nursing for the civilians there, but she also did make contact with some American prisoners and began the long process of trying to get word of her husband.
That was such a brilliant choice to pick Lithuania, because she didn't speak a word of Lithuanian, and neither did anybody else.
Right, and that was kind of the same reason why Claire Phillips pretended she was Italian. She figured that she would also not be running into especially any Japanese in the Philippines who would expect to hear Italian from her, although one night in her nightclub, she did get a Japanese officer ask her to sing something in Italian, and she didn't know anything except for some garbled verses of O Solo Mio, which kind of got her through it, but that was about all she could do.
Is that in the book?
I think it is.
Oh, okay. Wow. I love that. The book is Angels of the Underground, The American Women Who Resisted the Japanese in the Philippines in World War II. Teresa Kaminsky wrote it, and Teresa is a history professor at the University of Wisconsin at Stevens Point. What is that like, to teach history, to write about history? How did you get this history bug?
Oh, that's a good question. I guess when I first went to college, I just thought that studying history and studying political science were the best things to do in college. And after getting an undergraduate degree, I then had to figure out how I was going to use that information, all of that desire to hopefully show other people why this is all so interesting. And the only thing I could think of after that was to go on to graduate school. And I've been pretty lucky in my career. I think most people kind of follow the fortunes of higher education these days, and everywhere there are a lot of budget cuts and a lot of very qualified people and very few job openings.
Mm.
I've been fortunate enough to be teaching here at Stevens Point for over 20 years now, and it does really help in terms of the kind of research and writing I do. These are things that I can talk about with my students. They tend to know the big things. You know, they know about Pearl Harbor. They know about World War II, but they don't know about these smaller stories that are just as important to understanding the big picture in history.
We have time for just one more quick question. What is it that you find so compelling about the Philippines?
I think it probably goes back to my father, who actually joined the Army after World War II. He was a bit too young, and he tried a couple of times when he was a teenager to join up and fight in World War II, but he got turned away at the recruiting offices. So as soon as he turned 18, he joined the Army, and he ended up spending some of his post-World War II Army career then both in occupied Japan and in the Philippines. And he used to talk about the Philippine Islands, and it just always sounded like a really fascinating place.
Oh, my. Well, we really appreciate your time today.
Well, you're very welcome.
My guest has been Teresa Kaminsky. Her book is Angels of the Underground, The American Women Who Resisted the Japanese in the Philippines in World War II. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McKeonis. Thanks for tuning in.